States. You know, we'd all like to get back to normal. You know, this summer, once 68% of Americans were vaccinated, you know, people started going to the shore, they started traveling, you know, the national parks were filled to beyond capacity. And all of this, you know, was like saying, let's get back to normal, let's go back. And I have a lot of that myself. You know, I would love to just get back to normal. But coming to Sesshin is an interesting thing, you know. When you want to get back to normal, that usually means there's something you aren't dealing with, actually. Yesterday I mentioned that when things begin to fall apart, as they have been doing, people want to go back and want to repeat their old behaviors, right? So as things fall apart, as people become less secure, they want to repeat their old behaviors. But repeating the old behaviors doesn't solve the problem, because they're part of the reason you have the problem. So you know, we all want to repeat. You know, we all want to go back and do something that we did in the past that may have worked for us, or that we might have thought worked for us. But, you know, actually, we need to change our way of life. We need to change our way of life, not just as individuals, but as a whole society. And we have a crisis after crisis facing us. And as those crises mount up, you know, personal crises and societal crises, you know, we want to repeat like magic formulas that worked in the past. And actually, that's the worst thing we can do. You know, I think I mentioned this, but baseball players are incredibly superstitious. So, you know, the baseball players often have personal rituals. So, you know, let's say you're a ball player and you're waiting to go up to bat, and your batting average that year hasn't been very good. But that day, instead of having oatmeal, you were out of oatmeal and you had some Cheerios or something, and a glass of juice, which is something you don't normally do. And then you put milk in your coffee, even though you usually don't do that. And then, you know, just before you came up to the home plate, picked up the bat, you rubbed your hands together, which is also something you don't usually do. So then you pick up the bat and you hit the ball and it sails out of the stadium. So ball players are incredibly superstitious. You know, if it worked once, they make like, they have like these fetishistic behaviors, you know. So, and they'll eat Cheerios before they, on the day they're scheduled to go to bed, they'll eat Cheerios, they'll drink coffee with milk, they'll rub their hands together before they pick up the bat, you know, trying to make the mojo happen again. And this is very human, right? Very human. But as a society, you know, we have to change. And I actually think what we're doing here at Sesshin is really crucial. I think the quest for insight and wisdom that we are engaged in is really something that our country needs to do. And I don't necessarily think it's going to happen, but we can make it happen here. You know, so when we have been through so much that is so difficult, and, you know, traumatizing, really. You know, our impulse is to repeat, is to do what we did before. And, you know, you can lose yourself in a kind of nostalgia for the past. I guess that's the only kind of nostalgia. You can lose yourself in nostalgia. You know, and then you can miss the opportunity to do something new, to be creative in this moment, not the past. in Seattle, I had a job that gave very little money, and I could rent an apartment on what I made in various jobs that I had, working in a restaurant, moving furniture. You know, I could have my own apartment, believe it or not. You know, things were so cheap. And there was this vibe in the air, right, where everything was hopeful, you know, really hopeful. So, you know, in the early 70s, in the mid-70s, you know, even though the country had been a lot through a lot of tragedy, Vietnam and so on, there was like this hopeful vibe. And I mentioned that when Genki Roshi arrived from Japan, and the word got around that this Japanese Zen master had come from Japan, you know, like 40 people showed up to see him. And they were all like under 30 or under 35. So you had all these young people, and they were very optimistic, very, very optimistic about the future. And life was really easy, right? You know, it was easy to pay the bills. And pretty soon, this Seattle Zen Center took off, and we built, we rented a house, and I was just, you know, I was just going along for the ride. You know, we rented a house, and so we started having sitting there in the morning and the evening, and I would get up in the morning and catch the bus and go up to Capitol Hill and sit in the morning. And then I went home and I had my job. I go down the hill, down into the U District, in the summer I had a job. And then in the evening, I'd catch the same bus up to Capitol Hill again and do Zazen twice a day. And I didn't have a plan. It was just there. And you know what? The place would be packed. You know, the building, this little house that we were renting would be packed. We'd have 15 or 20 people in the living rooms. And you know, pretty soon we kept moving so much we had to look for a bigger place. And then, you know, we bought some property outside of Seattle near a town called Clay Elm, which is in the middle of, it's a little bit, you know, east of Ellensburg, if you know Washington State. And we started building this temple. And, you know, all of this was like a dream come true, you know, dream come true. You know, in the early years of our community, there was just like this, all of us had discovered something, right? You know, that when you start doing Zen, you know, you may have the same motivations I had. You know, you may feel emotional distress because of various things that have happened in your life, or maybe you have an anxiety disorder, or maybe you're a little bit depressed. But, you know, when you start doing Zen, you begin to experience something really special, really wonderful, really, you know, that we don't even necessarily have words for. You know, all day long, I'm busy being Kurt, you know. So I get up in the morning and I'm Kurt. And I think to myself, what does Kurt want for breakfast? What does Kurt have to do? You know, Kurt has his tasks. Kurt has to wash his face and so on. And it's Kurt, Kurt, Kurt a lot of the day. And, you know, if I hadn't found Zen, I'm not sure I would have ever discovered that there's a deeper way to live. So you know, I like to hike, and I like to go out into nature. And it made me very happy to be out into nature. So I've kind of already discovered this thing, this other mode of being. But when I started doing Zen, I began to experience it in a deep and sustained way, not just when I was out in the woods, but actually all the time. A monk asked Joshu, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming to China? Joshu said, the cypress tree in the garden. See, we experience the world in ordinary consciousness as separate from ourselves. And, you know, there's lots of reasons we experience it as separate from ourselves. You know, I can remember being a little boy. It's a memory, and it may be a false memory, but it may not be. I remember once my mother unscrewed a light bulb in a lamp, and I looked down into the chamber, right? And I said, "What will happen if I put my finger down in there?" And she said, "You'll get a shock." And I stuck my finger down, and I got a shock. It's like, whoa. She said, "I told you." You stick your finger into something and get a shock enough times, and you're more careful about it, right? You know, when my father was relatively young, we moved to Baltimore, and my father's job was outside of Baltimore. So I went to Baltimore Public School, and even in the 60s, you know, they were actually pretty tough environment, pretty difficult. And when I would go to school, I was always wondering if somebody was going to beat me up, you know. So yeah, I can remember being so excited about school, you know, so excited about going to school. And I would watch movies about kids in school and working, like I'd watch a Disney movie about, you know, kids in a school, and they're in chemistry class, and they're mixing chemicals, and you know, the kid does something and turns into a dog. And I couldn't wait to get into the laboratory. Right? The laboratory. It's, of course, they don't let you use the laboratory in the first grade, right? So school was really different from what I imagined, and all of these experiences separate us, and we forget about what Zen calls the great matter, this great matter. I picked up the habit of being like a hiker. When I would go out in the woods, I would feel this returning sense of connection and trust. And when I started going to the Zen Center in Seattle, I started feeling this great matter. You sit down on the cushion and you have pain in your legs. You have all these goddamn thoughts, right? But after a while, you begin to feel like you're in something. You're in. It's like a connection with something. You can't say what it is. Right? You can't say what it is. But when that happens, it's like it can feel like going home. I remember we used to have, before we had our own place in the Seattle Zen Center, we used to go over to Vashon Island and have our retreats over at a place on Vashon Island, and we were all waiting for the ferry, all of us Zen students. And I was talking to a woman named Abby Terrace, runs the Corvallis Zen Center, which she has done for like 25 years. Beautiful place. And Abby just said to me, she'd just gotten into this for a couple of years, and she said, "You know, I just can't stop doing this because, you know, I feel like I've gone home when I do Zazen, when I sit down on the cushion." And I knew exactly what she meant. It's like, I know exactly what she meant. So I feel like I've gone home. There's something about this experience of Zazen, right, that takes you to that place. And as a community, you know, we were all sort of like experiencing that wondrous wonder of discovering this great matter all together. And, you know, for about 3 or 4 years, it was really like magic, you know. Everybody would show up and sit, everybody was, a lot of people were going to Sesshin on a regular, you know, people were able to, in those days, come to Sesshin quite regularly. And you know, we were busy with Zen and breaking through barriers. It was like paradise, really like paradise. But you know, then there started being all these tensions in the group, you know, you'd go for coffee and somebody would say, I don't know if I don't like Bill, you know, I don't like Bill. You know, he's so into himself, you know, and somebody would say, oh, I agree, you know. Pretty soon there was all this undercurrent of like tension in our group. And, ultimately, lots of these tensions boiled up and produced like a little civil war. And blew our group to pieces, you know, actually blew the group to pieces. And, it's easy to, a lot of people I know who are part of that community were just shell-shocked by this experience. It was like, how did this happen? Because, you know, we were this wonderful community. We had all discovered this matter together. And it brought us all to life. It was like we had all gone home together. And then little by little, all this stuff started coming up that tore the community into several pieces. This piece went that way, this piece went that way. And I know a lot of people, even now, are sort of like traumatized by that. Like, how did this happen? How could this happen? And it took me a lot of sitting to figure this one out, you know. Encountering this matter is not the end of the story. You know, when you come to the place in yourself where you feel connected to the world, congratulations, you know, that just getting there is hard. But yet, you know, then, you know, we have to clean up. We have to take that connectedness and work through our obstacles. Work through our obstacles, the shadows in ourselves. Right? And if we can't get to that place where we feel home and safe and connected, that's very difficult to work through the shadows, right? You'll probably never do it. You'll just be chased by your shadows. But, you know, we fell apart for a reason, you know, because we hadn't dealt with our shadows. We hadn't dealt with our unenlightened parts of ourselves, right? You know, we found enlightenment in a way, you know, not complete enlightenment, but we found enlightenment. But we didn't find the unenlightened part of ourselves. Right? And I know people who've been my friends for 50 years who are just like still traumatized by what happened. But, you know, they want to repeat the past. They want to go back to and do again what worked before. But actually, that never works, right? Never works. You know, so a lot of what we have to do when things fall apart is to go ground ourselves in that great matter, that, you know, wonderful, wonderful place. See? And then, you know, we have to work through our obstacles, to discover and work through our obstacles. And it was hard for a lot of people in my Zen community, the Zen community that was like my family, you know, back then. It was hard for that people in that family to work through those obstacles because, you know, they thought they were there. You know, they go to Sesshin, and after Sesshin, you know, the laughter and the happiness and the feelings of, you know, love. You know, but then later, where's all this hostility coming from? Where's all this anger coming from? This resentment, these Oedipal issues, you know. And it's like two different, it's like this is one picture and this is the other picture, and they don't go together. But you know, they go together. They have to go together. And the road to wholeness is putting them together. See, and this is true for us in our own lives too, personally, right? You know, we have these experiences sometimes of like being there in this great matter, being present with this great matter. And it is so beautiful, right? Sometimes on the cushion, our legs stop hurting, our back stops hurting. The mental chatter stops, and we suddenly feel this great matter envelop us. Like, this is so precious. You know, people don't, a lot of people never really have a deep experience of that. Right? I personally think Zen is the most, Buddhism, Zen for me, is the most wonderful thing. You know, I feel like this, what did I ever do to deserve this? You know, it is such a beautiful road, you know. What did I ever do to deserve this? I can't imagine that I did anything good enough to justify this, you know, to justify my access to this. You know, so beautiful, but, you know, you can't really get to that place or fully realize that great matter unless we work through the obstacles that we have, the shadows, right? You know, and that's true for us as a country also, right? I mean, all of these bad things have happened to us in the last 6 years. We've had a dictator, basically. We've had an economic collapse that showed how exposed everybody is to insecurity, economic insecurity. We have had a pandemic, and this collapse of our empire, our overseas empire. Right? And you know, unless as a country we face some of these shadows, we can't go forward. And that's why I think something like Buddhism is so important. Right? Not only do we know how to find this great matter, but we also know how to work through our obstacles. Right? And that's what makes this practice, I think, so extraordinary. You know, it's really hard to admit, you know, it's really hard to admit that we're incomplete. You know? So you know, we work very hard to make a full life. To make a full life, you know, we do this and we do this and we do this, and you know, we can be very successful at it, right? We can be very successful at it, but you know, there's always a kind of illusion involved in that. So, you know, for example, I was just reading the other day about Ernest Hemingway. And, you know, Ernest Hemingway had a really charmed life. You know, his father committed suicide. He had a sort of a tense, difficult family background. But he wanted to be a writer. And he started writing these novels, and he worked really hard at this, right? And he wrote these short stories that were quite beautiful, you know, in our time, if you have a chance to read those short stories. And then he wrote a couple of novels. He wrote a novel called Men Without Women, and he wrote another novel called The Torrents of Spring. You know, and these novels would all come out, they'd sell a few thousand copies, right? And Hemingway worked like a dog, right? He would sit day in and day out writing these novels, and he he's writing these novels and improving his artistry, his craft gets better and better. Then he writes this novel called In Our Time. The Sun Also Rises. And I highly recommend it. It's a beautiful novel. But that didn't sell that well either. It did okay, right? But many people thought it was really good. And then he wrote this novel called A Farewell to Mars. And I was reading that the publisher thought it was going to do pretty well and published 30,000 copies. But they sold out like in a couple of weeks. And by the time the book was out for a year, and it sold 100,000 copies, which is really good, right? And, you know, that was like the high point of Hemingway's life, right? And from there on, it's kind of like downhill, you know, for him personally. His drinking gets out of control. He starts having like serial divorces. You know, it all falls apart, and he can't really like change. Can't change. And you know, something I read about him. You know, I think he's trying to repeat. You know, he kept trying to go through these experiences that he had had as a young man and make them happen again. And he wasn't able to take what was happening to him now and work through it and create something new. And he wasn't able to find his shadows and work them through. You know, he had a lot of unresolved issues, right? So this is like a human story. But it's our story because we're human. So you know, day two of Sasheen is like, everything about Sasheen, I think, is like amazing and wonderful. You know, day one of Sasheen, we have all these loops in our head. And day two, maybe you're starting to get calm. You're starting to approach the great matter. Maybe not yet. Maybe that'll be tomorrow for you. You know, and then, you know, either before or after that, you know, it's very important to go into, to do the work of our koan practice, which is confronting our obstacles, right? When we are sitting in the zendo and we go into deep mushin, we feel sometimes this deep sense of connection, and then, you know, the bell rings and you go outside and you walk along the flower beds, let's say. And, you know, if you're in the right state of mind, if your barriers have been peeled away, you know, you feel this deep, intimate connection with things around you. It's like there's no wall now of fear or projection between you and the objects of your attention. Yesterday afternoon, I was sitting on the couch drinking some tea, and I looked over and there's this hummingbird going from flower to flower, and it's like, this is perfect, right? This is the world, the universe is perfect right now. And, you know, when you're in the right state of mind, when you've been meditating for 9 hours, you know, you become the hummingbird. You become the flowers, right? So wonderful. It's a little harder to become one with our shadows, but it's a little harder. It's a little harder, you know, to encounter those things in ourselves which are our obstacles. It's relatively easy to become one with the hummingbird. Little harder to become one with something that hurt us in life, you know. But, you know, in order to understand things, whether it's something beautiful or something terrible, we have to become one with it. You have to ask. It's so hard. Right? Because when things are happening that we don't is a formula for failure, because as the Buddha said, things are always changing. So in order to be creative with what's happening now, you know, we need to let go of the past, and we need to become one with what's happening, with the difficulties now, you know. You can't work through your obstacles unless you become one with your obstacles. That's sort of the hard part of this koan. You know, when you're sitting in the zendo and you're watching your breath and you're watching your breath and you're watching your breath, you say, tree, 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 tree. What the hell could he have in mind? And, you know, maybe you walk outside and you see the hummingbird. You become one with the hummingbird. So beautiful. But, you know, as long as we can't become one with everything that's happening, everything that's happening. You know, we aren't fully awake, right? That everything becomes an obstacle when we push it away. And so, you know, the path to awakening is to become one with everything we encounter. That's very difficult. You know, my friends in the Seattle Zen Center went through that traumatic experience, and many of them have never become one with it. You know, and so they're sort of like in limbo, you know, in limbo. These are friends of mine that I love dearly. You know, they loved this Zen, and it fell apart, and they walked away, and now there's a hole in their life. And I'll say to them sometimes, look, you know, you live in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Why don't you go study at Upaya Zen Center? It's one of the best Zen centers in the United States. Oh, no, not me. So it's like, I'm not going to do that because I might get hurt again, right? And so the past has become this obstacle for them that they can't overcome. And so they're unwilling to move into the future because of their inability to become one with the past. And this is extremely important. Now, I have another friend of mine who was a Zen priest at that center, and when it fell apart, you know, he too went through a long period of you know, feeling betrayed, not necessarily by Zen, but by life. You know, since then, he's created this wonderful, wonderful group. You know, the Choboji Zen group. So, you know, he took this experience, which was traumatic, you know, but he was able to become one with it. And that allowed him to go forward into the future. And as long as we're not able to do that, we can't go. We're arrested, we're frozen. We'll keep repeating. So day two is, you know, our opportunity. You know, that those moments we've had of wholeness, those moments in the past are in the past. But, you know, everything is helping us wake up. Everything is helping us wake up. And as we're going forward, you know, we have to continue to become one with what's happening now. And if we do that, those beautiful moments will be, that paradise will be back. It'll be back tomorrow or the next day or the day after that and the day after that and the day after that. So becoming one with is our secret, is our Zen secret. And the path to liberation is becoming one with what we don't necessarily want to become one with. A monk called Joshu, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming to China? Joshu said, in the garden. Who wants commentary? If you understand Joshua's answer intimately, if you're intimate with the world around you, there is no Shaka before you, no Maitreya to come. Who wants verse? Words cannot express things. Speech does not convey the spirit. Swayed by words, one is lost. Locked by phrases, one is bewildered.